why you gents are interested in our event in DC, what attracted you to it and so on. I know it's not the copious amounts of money, but maybe if we start off with yourself, Paul.
Well, when I started this YouTube thing, I decided that wherever possible, I would have a disposition to say yes to things. And of course, Marcus, we met online, and then we did the Ireland thing with my trip to Europe, which was great fun. And I met Joe with his Just for Joe channel, and you guys said, "Oh, why don't you come to DC and do something?" And I thought, let's see if it fits. And like I said, I have family on the East Coast, and so it's a good excuse to get to the East Coast, and a little jaunt to DC is not a big deal. So, and of course, I'd spoken with Michael before, and we're sort of swimming in the same channels, especially around sort of the Grail Country channel. And Spencer, I'd heard about before, and I'd watched some of his father's stuff on Daily Wire, and so I thought, no, it'd be fun to talk to these guys too. So why not? Why say no? So I said yes.
Thanks for that, Paul. And what about yourself then, Spencer?
You know, I mean, like Paul, I've had an online relationship with a lot of you. I think Michael's the only person that I've ever been physically in the same place with. And he and I had a moment, which at least to me was one of those sort of tugs on the sleeve that you sometimes get, where Michael quoted Thomas Traherne. I had just read Thomas Traherne for the first time and been absolutely lit aflame by him. So I turned to him after the conversation and I said, "Oh, I just love Thomas Traherne and I'm so excited to have found him." And it turned out that Michael wrote the introduction to and edited the edition that I had been reading. And so suddenly, you know, we had all sorts of things to talk about. And
And
then
that was in
as
DC. And that was in DC too,
That's right. I hadn't even thought about that. But yes, we meet again. We have to stop meeting like this. We should
No
go somewhere
kidding.
next time. Yeah. Yeah, no. And then the other aspect of it is that I am really interested in developing and finding ways to mediate between these very strange sorts of relationships that now come into being if you have any sort of online presence, or even if you don't, that can be quite intimate, but that don't actually have any, you know, physical embodiment. Joe and I talk all the time about how, you know, we hit it off when I was promoting my book on his channel, and then suddenly it sort of, you know, I forget whom I've met in person and whom I haven't. And at the same time, I have this really profound sense that online is not enough. You know, online has opened up all of these interesting new avenues, but it also seduces us into kind of forgetting that we have bodies and forgetting that we are in human relationship and all this stuff. And so when I go onto podcasts and stuff and promote my book, which is called How to Save the West, it's 60,000 words. I thought that was succinct at the price. But people will often say, like, how do you save the West in two sentences? And I always say, log off and go to church. And so this is like right in that wheelhouse. And I know that it's not possible for us, or even maybe desirable, to just totally, you know, monastically retreat from online. But I will end, I guess, by quoting my little nephew, who, when he was born, you know, my sister and I were living in different areas, and we have this kind of Skype relationship where I would call them every so often and we'd see each other and she'd have the baby. And then the first time or second time maybe that I visited when he was really starting to talk, he said, "Oh, you've come out of the computer. Like you've entered into real life." And then when I left, we were joking, like, "Okay, I'm going back into the computer now." And I'm interested in, like, how you sort of step through the screen and out into real life. And I think I'm hoping we'll kind of be practicing that even as we also talk about it. So there's a lot, and I'm just excited to meet all you guys in person.
Likewise, thanks, Spencer. And that's one thing I really appreciate about Michael's work too, in this kind of emphasis on alternative modernity. We're not sort of just retreating to nostalgia or anything, but we're not succumbing to the dark sides of modern technology and so on. And I think that's part of why I thought this would be such a good mixture. I see that in all of you guys. Would you like to speak to that a bit more on what appeals to you about this event, Michael?
First, I'm trying to think, you can't see this. Maybe yes, you can.
Oh,
There's
yeah.
Spencer.
There we are.
At dinner,
that
we went
great
to a
restaurant.
Russian restaurant.
Oh, that was so good, that food.
That yeah. was so good. And we had horseradish vodka with lard. I know it sounds horrible, but it was the best thing ever. Well, that's it. You know, like Spencer was saying, you know, I'm a sociologist and I'm a farmer. So things in the real world are much more interesting and important to me than the virtual world. I mean, as much as I appreciate the opportunity, like right now, we're having this conversation, which I do appreciate, right? But it's a different experience to be with someone, right? You could say, I mean, you know, to in a way, it's a, it mirrors the idea of church, you know, where, and because it's, you know how it is, it just feels different when you're with people, you know, and it, and there's more of a presence. And that's why for me, when I met Spencer in DC last time I was there, every time I go to DC, my wife's starting to talk. It was like Spencer said, it was like this kind of tug. I mean, it was like an indication to me that I was in the right place at the right time, you know, and I met the right people. And it was right after my mother's funeral. I mean, the day after I got on the plane to go there. And here I was, you know, and not only that, Spencer was, we had assigned seats and he was right next to me for
That's
the
right.
whole time. You know, so we're sitting next to each other. And did God put you here for a reason? I think yes. Right?
Yeah.
And it was really you know, like Spencer said, you get this little tug, this little reminder of why we're here. And I would prefer, you know, I would prefer that to anything. I mean, that's where in these live experiences, I mean, I think you know the experience. So you can see a film that's moving to you, right? But there's something when you go to the theater, when you come out of the theater, when you come out of the out of a movie, you might be enthused and excited, but there's also a tiredness that comes from staring at the screen, right? But when you come out of the theater, you feel enlivened because you have been seeing real bodies moving in real time, and we forget that. And we forget that. And the same thing with music, right? You were mentioning music before we went to record. And I do a demonstration with college students when I can, you know, by showing them the difference between music played live and music that's recorded, because most of their diet of music comes from recorded music. And it started off, there happened to be a piano in the room I was teaching in. And I couldn't get them to get the idea of phenomenology. I couldn't quite get it. So hold on here, I'll just do this. So I played them a recording of the Beatles playing Hey Jude. And then I sat up, went to the piano, and I'm not a great piano player, and I'm no Paul McCartney, but I sang the first few bars and played the piano. I said, which one's different? Or how are they different? And they all always prefer the one with me. And it's not because I'm Paul McCartney's equal. It's because if, and I say, why is it? Because it feels more real. It feels more real. And I think it's important. And I even done it with a guitar, with actually a recorded one of the songs I recorded, and showed them the difference between me recorded and me in the same room. And there's no comparison. And I think, we live in a world that has less and less of those experiences, where our experiences are mediated through technology. And I would like to fight the technocracy, right?
Amen. And Joe and I, on the plus side of technology, have developed this friendship very quickly. and we're kind of struck by how similar that our kind of stories were. He interviewed me for his channel. We had a great conversation. And then we've had follow-up conversations, obviously, for my channel. And like me, Joe was into all of this kind of abstract philosophy, New Age sort of stuff. And eventually, by God's grace, came to Christ and saw the importance of the incarnation, everything to do with the incarnation and so on. And I suppose this is an extension of that, I think, and the importance of embodied community and so on. But I'd love to hear a few of your thoughts, Joe, about what you hope to get out of an event like this and how it builds upon some of the stuff that you've been doing on The Gist with Joe, for example.
Oh, yeah, thank you. And I will say, you know, yeah, The Gist with Joe is on maybe like a little hiatus. This is not the space to get into it because I kind of just started a whole new career. I have not had the time or energy to really get out and interview interesting men such like yourselves. But, you know, whenever I have little pockets of time, I do plan to continue. And I hopefully one day will, but one day very soon, hopefully within the next month, have some time where I can sit down and, you know, begin to record again after a month. But I really don't think I say it any better than what you gentlemen have already said, right? I mean, this is exactly why I'm so excited about the event. And this is why I'm excited when Marcus asked me to essentially, you know, help him create this experience. I was elated because, yeah, I mean, the way I put it is I've never been really an internet guy. I mean, obviously I am on the internet a good amount of time, but you know, maybe 3-4 years ago, I decided to be social media free. And that has been like a really difficult, that's been a really difficult thing to continue. Or that's a very difficult thing to abstain from. I mean, relationships I had from undergrad have been lost, right? Because I can't talk to them anymore. Or, you know, I'm not posting really cool things on Instagram, or I have a lot of things that I want to, I have a lot of things both professionally and personally in my life that I'm very proud of. And that I do want to show off, right? And the platform to do that is, right, I will post a picture of my wife and I doing something fun on Instagram, or we'll talk about our growing family, et cetera, et cetera. I have a platform to discuss my new job. These are all very difficult things not to have because your ego gets in the way and you go, I want to do this too. But what I've done, I've done the opposite, right? And I've tried to just keep a close circle of friends that I engage with personally. But when I realized that I wanted to be, I don't know, I guess just part of the conversation more, that's when I decided that I wanted to start the YouTube channel. And again, this is the avenue that I met all of you gentlemen. And it's been great. And it's actually showed me. So before I kind of was the extreme. I was like, well, you know, we shouldn't have social media at all. Right? And it's a hindrance to our life. And by my YouTube channel, by meeting all of you, and specifically speaking, the friendships that I've created with Marcus and Spencer, and how they're actual like real friendships. Like these aren't just, you know, we're hopping on and we're playing, you know, video games for an hour and a half and then we're hopping off. I mean, no, I talk to, you know, these individuals on a daily basis for, you know. With that being said, I've learned that the internet is obviously a very valuable tool. And without the internet, we would not be doing things like this right now. I mean, Marcus is in Ireland, you know, Paul's in California, I'm in Ohio, Tennessee, Michigan, respectively. But again, because the thing that unites us all is Christianity, right? That would be I'm sure we'll get into other commonalities that we have, but I think the most important commonality that we have is that we are all together in Christ in some way. And because Christianity is, right, incarnational, it is our task as Christians to, well, create and to make more vivid the incarnational truth that Christianity has. So getting together and holding events and taking time, scheduling time throughout all of our busy year, right? I mean, our year is probably booked with things and we've scheduled this months in advance, but to actually say, I'm going to take out time and effort, and I'm even going to spend money to get to a particular location so that we can all meet each other and join each other in community, I think right there in and of itself expresses how important it is that we connect physically with one another. And that's why I'm just so excited to have this event.
Excellent. Thanks for that, Joe. And when looking at this big picture, I thought, whilst we're quite an idiosyncratic bunch, I think, and I was discerning some key trends, some of which you've just hinted at. And I think with Spencer's book, I thought that that might be a good place to look to explore some of those commonalities that you're speaking about, Joe. So in your book, How to Save the West, Spencer, which you and I spoke about with Jonathan Bajot, which was amazing. But Jonathan's so funny because he, one of the first things he says, oh, obviously I haven't read your book yet, but that always cracks me up. But we never got to go through.
He has such intelligent things to say about it.
For 100%.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that just, I think, speaks to the point that we're exploring these common spaces. But that was such a productive conversation, and you getting you together with people like Paul would really work. And I think your conversation recently kind of vindicated me in that too. But I thought it might be cool to maybe, we can go in different directions, but I thought it might be cool to map onto your book and see how that pertains to this little corner of the internet, as is talked about and so on. So we've hinted at this crisis of reality. So we talk a lot in this little corner of the internet about the meaning crisis, but you speak about five major crises. And one of them is that crisis of reality where the virtual world almost becomes a simulacrum for these embodied communities and so on. And we perceive people as their little avatars. And Joe mentioned this Instagram kind of lifestyle, whereas you're only seeing the positives of someone's life. And whenever it comes to that extent, you're not actually seeing reality. Maybe you'd like to speak to that. And I'd like to then jump into some of the pastoral implications of that for Paul, and then hear some of Michael's thoughts too. Does that make sense, Spencer?
Sure, absolutely. It's funny because as I was listening to each of you talk, and even as sort of I was listening to myself, I was struck again with this thought that the real, what is real, is such a palpable thing for each of us and so obviously desirable. I mean, Michael, when you were talking about that specific sense of sluggishness that descends over the eyes after a long period in front of a screen, even if the content that the screen is mediating has real value, is rich and significant. The difference between watching Denzel Washington do Macbeth very beautifully on the screen versus going to the RSC or even just to your local theater. I was reminded again that, for me at least, the idea of the real is urgently important and also resists the kind of neat philosophical definition that people like me are typically quite comfortable with. And anything that you come up with to nail it down into a sort of Platonic or Aristotelian syllogism always fails to fully capture quite the qualitative aspects of what you're looking for. That maybe the best way to make a distinction between real and unreal, or more real and less real, is to do what you were describing, this sort of phenomenological approach, that listen to this live music. And we all know that somehow, you know, on one level, of course, everything that we're doing right now is real. It is really the case that I am sitting here in front of my phone talking to you guys. And I believe that you are real on the other end of the line and all of those things. And yet there is some sort of fissure or intervention that's going on between us that we don't get in person. And so I was sitting here and thinking about, you know, my book begins kind of with a little essay that takes you from Zuckerberg's metaverse to Plato's cave, and is supposed to illustrate that this is a perennial temptation and a perennial problem to just try and seize control of an illusory reality. And I guess one thing that, now that I'm talking through this and thinking about it with you guys, one way of talking about the real is to say it's the thing that you can't wish away, right? It's that it has some aspect to it that is not responsive to the mere will. It is possible to will and then execute changes in the real world, but it's not possible simply by wishing it to restructure reality. And one thing that online seems to me to do is tempt us with the illusion that we can actually change sort of the way that our universe, at least, is structured with increasingly small gestures of the will, with a press of a button, right? And I think, for instance, about how much more charming and self-assured I am over text message than I am in person. I've noticed recently that I'll get into these like text message exchanges with people and think, oh yeah, we have this really great connection. And then you meet them in person, you suddenly realize that I've been flattering myself somehow with this confected version of myself that is purely textual and also purely digital. So coming up against the hard boundaries of a reality that can't actually be wished away or fabricated away, has struck me again and again as it's a kind of path to God, to be as blunt about it as possible. C.S. Lewis talks about the tug on the other end of the line, that it's sort of alarming to us to think that God is not an amorphous jelly disseminated through space or a power field that we can access. But, you know, the hunter, the king, the friend, the individual on the other end of this cosmic line. And I think from there, kind of the reason that the most essential aspect of that in our experience is your brother, is your friend, is other people, is because other people embody that, incarnate that for us. And the sort of real inescapable fact of them, of others, is what Iris Murdoch arrives at when she says that, you know, love and so art and morals all consist in the extremely difficult realization that something other than oneself is real. And that being forced to confront that reality again and again is the maybe the thing that's most kind of come back to me that I've wanted to dwell on more since writing that book and thinking more about it, that, you know, it's the inescapable reality of other people that seems like most needful to recover or remind ourselves of in this hyper-digital environment.
You know, can I? Oh, go ahead, Marcus. I'm so sorry.
No, jump in there, Joe.
No, I was resonating with what you were saying, and I'm thinking about. So, people who don't know, you know, I have a young family, right? And so I have a 2-year-old at home, or he'll be 2, and he's now and Michael and Paul, I think you'll know exactly what I mean, obviously raising your own kids. So now he's at the point, and he's been at this point for a couple of months now, where, you know, he knows obviously like what a tree is, right? So he can go outside and he can look at the tree and he'll go, oh, tree, 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 or bird, birdie, birdie, birdie. But then when it's on the screen, or if he sees a picture of a tree or a bird, and let's say like he knows like what an actual real life bird looks like, right? And the cartoon birds, right, that he's witnessing don't look like real birds, but he can actually still understand that this is a bird, right? Or that the tree in the book that we're reading to him is a tree, even if it looks nothing like. Well, it does look something like, obviously, but it doesn't look exactly the same way as the tree outside. And so I think it's so interesting, and I might be missing the mark on this, but I do think it's very interesting that how quickly, maybe just because that's how it's the only way we can exist in the world, but how quickly we can lose, right, the understanding of what is truly real. So like my son can truly say what he can truly understand what a tree is, but he also is able to sense that something is a tree. And like the picture of the tree is not actually a tree, right? It's just a representation of the tree, but he thinks it's still an actual tree. And it's just, what I'm trying to get at is, it's just very interesting how quickly we lose and we're able, how quickly we can identify that which isn't actually real. It's just a symbolic representation of the thing that is truly real. And we've never taught him this, right? So this is like not something that my wife and I have said, oh, hey, you know, this is a tree and this is a tree, but it's different. No. This is something that he just has innately done. And I just think that's so interesting that, well, it's just so, you know, at 2 years old already, you can quickly, I don't want to say lose, because not losing, obviously, what is truly real, right? The actual tree itself, but it makes it just makes the waters a little more murky, yeah. Right?
May I?
That makes sense.
May I? So here's the thing, and this has been my anxiety about the internet for the longest time, because the internet or social media wants to turn you into an avatar,
yeah,
of yourself, right? And that's the temptation to be. We have the temptation to behave as the avatar of ourselves, just like a cartoon, you know, like those avatars that Facebook's always trying to get you to use. I don't want to be a cartoon, right? Mm. But that's the tendency. I don't know what that is, but there's a tendency to turn oneself into an avatar and to interpret other people as avatars as well, right? If you're talking about the real, I mean, this is the medium is the message, right? So this medium tends to do that to people. It's reductive in that way, right? Mm-hmm. And this is, Marshall McLuhan knew this long ago, right? So the medium is the message, right? This is the containing box in the virtual reality. This is the step towards virtual reality. And this meeting we're going to have in DC, and anytime we get together in the real world, that's the kind of the antidote to that, because, and, you know, and it's interesting because my now everybody here I met online except for Spencer. Mm-hmm. I didn't know about Spencer's work until I met Spencer, and then I checked him out. So it's a very different experience when you meet somebody in the real world. And I mean, and I think it's impossible to not project an aspect of our personalities, especially in the kind of informal ways of, you know, whether it's a Twitter post or a Facebook post, that's only a little, it's like a little sliver. It's not the being, right? And if we have the experience of the being, you know, this is the thing. And I think this is important to what you were talking about, Joe, with, because I think what we're all stumbling toward is trying to describe a sacramental reality, right? And this is what makes life worth living, right? It certainly is, right? Whether it's love between, whether it's friendship, whether it's love between two people, whatever, you know, the arts. This is what I think Spencer really is into. Memorization of poetry, because it's not memorization, it's recitation, it's dwelling in the poem, right? Yeah. It's and you have when you do that, you take on a different relationship to the language and to the person who wrote it, right? You dwell in it in a Heideggerian sense. You live in it, right? And I think, you know, and the going forward as humanity, you know, that's the one of the things that's going to be the challenge is how do we keep that alive? How do we keep that in, especially, I mean, I think this is accelerated, as we all know, during COVID when everybody was sent home to work online. As a professor, that was hell. Just telling you right now, and not only teaching online is hell, but then going back to school and teaching in masks was also hell. Because you never or very rarely could. In fact, if you think about that, it's a mask, right? It's something in between the being and the world, right? It's a persona. It's projection. It's a projection. And what we're interested here is parousia, presence, right? And that's when I figured out that parousia means presence and not second coming, that really changed my understanding of the New Testament, right? From St. Paul. Because that's what we're trying to live into, is that presence. And this thing in DC we're gonna do in a couple weeks, that's how I kind of envision that participation, right? As a participation of presence.
Yeah. Hmm. Thanks, Michael. And Paul, I'd be keen to hear some of your thoughts as a pastor on this topic specifically, whether that is, say, reflecting on your early work as a pastor versus now, some of the different challenges, some of the different possibilities. I think you've said in the past that don't call me your pastor like online, which I was almost tempted to do. And
not your internet pastor. There's no such thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, it's good actually. Yeah,
like it's that. Like those farms on Facebook. Remember the Facebook farms?
Oh yeah. Yeah, the little farm games that people would have. But it's that. It's the tension that a number of you have already noted, that actually I am people's internet pastor, and I usually make sure I keep the word in there, because I always lead with reminding people that your real pastor knows you not via a screen, but in this physical world. Yet, part of what has been interesting has been that I've been doing this internet thing for about 5 years. People through the internet will come and tell me things sometimes, not all, but that some of my in physical space membership won't. This is analogous in some ways to why there's therapy, and this will touch on your discipline, Joseph, psychology, where you meet, you know, the therapist meets the patient, and you have all that medical framing around it. The therapist meets the patient in a room. It's not the therapist's home. It's not the patient's home. Family members aren't there. The therapist likely has no knowledge of anybody else. There's a degree to which the internet and these screens are like that. Whereas with the people that are in my physical church, I have known them. I've been here at this church for 25 years. I know their children to a degree. I know their parents to a degree. I know their siblings to a degree. I know there's some of their coworkers. So it is a question of these boxes. You know, Michael, as you were talking, I was thinking about the fact that one of the things that has developed in churches is that the church itself as a context also governs presence. When people come into church, there's usually a masking. And this is something pastors deal with all the time. They come into church and there's a masking. There's a masking of certain sides of their life that they don't want others in church to see or know about. They might have other communities that know about it, but they don't want the church people to know about it. And so one of the things that we are very adept at as human beings is this identity shifting, this shape shifting in different places. And so you have people who come to church and they're one way. In the business world, they're another way. You know, maybe they have a second family. And when I worked in the Dominican Republic, there was the one way to sort of always get at another pastor, if you really wanted to do them in, was accuse them of having a second family in Haiti, you know, one in the Dominican Republic and one in Haiti. And part of what the internet has done is, on one hand, created these, there's a, Georg Mueller, Hans Georg Mueller is a teaches philosophy in, I think, Macau. He's got his own YouTube channel, and he talks about profelicity, how what is happening on the internet with Instagram, with Facebook, with YouTube, is we are curating a profile of ourselves. And in that sense, we're continuing to segment reality, and in the process, segment ourselves by multiplying our faces to all of these different arenas. One of the most interesting conversations I've done this year, which will probably come out in my channel over the next week or so, is with an Israeli who got into professional wrestling in middle school. And when he said that, it was like, what exactly are we talking about here? When people are playing basketball or soccer or some of these other things, he started playing around with professional wrestling in middle school. And we talked about the fact that over time, in terms of the reaction between the audience and what's going on inside the ring, a character emerged. And for him, it's Lenny Levi. And that's different from Guy Landau, the in real life guy who has a girlfriend and is developing a course on modern Hebrew as a second language and all of these other things. But in the ring, he's Lenny Levi. And what we've done with these internet spaces is, you know, so I'm Paul Vanderclay, but what Paul Vanderclay means for thousands of people out in the world is a little bit different than what Paul Vanderclay means or Pastor Paul means in this building, and then Father means in that space. And like Joe with your son is, because this has been a reality of human beings. You know, this is not new, but we have created an entirely different arena and new arena for this profile identity shifting, which then sort of goes back to Spencer's question about, okay, when we use this word real, what do we mean? Eugene Peterson passed away not too long ago, was very much a mentor for a lot of sort of moderate Protestant clergy. And Eugene Peterson was always irked. He was a mainline pastor in the DC area, I believe. And he'd have these smart businessmen or political types who would say, oh, pastor, fine sermon. Now I'm heading out into the real world. And of course, Eugene Peterson would always bristle with that and say, no, you've been in the real world. Now you're heading out into something else. Yeah. And so for all of us now, we're wrestling to figure out these multiple worlds and what in fact transcends them, governs them, and then the multiple personalities that we are, and where is the through line and the thread that holds them together.
Hmm. You know, there's so much here. Marcus, can I jump in for a second? Is that
please answer? Yeah.
Great. Paul, as you were talking, it suddenly occurred to me what going on your channel reminded me of, because I so enjoyed our conversation, and there's a certain feeling when you really get a sense of being listened to, as I told you then, and I just realized that it felt like stepping into a confessional booth. It felt like there was this the online boxes of the two of the Zoom call almost were like the, you know, the priest and the confessor sort of separated by that screen in a Catholic church. And it speaks to the fact that whereas we absolutely are kind of tempted into this masking online, it's also possible across the same medium to unmask. And all of this talking that we're doing about artifice, and certainly the split personality, the multiple personalities, it sort of raises this, it heightens, I guess, this problem that is perennial, which is how is it possible to be sincere at all? How is it possible, online or off, anywhere, to take this totally ineffable and indeed infinite thing called the psyche, the human soul, and somehow like reify it into a gesture, a word, a grunt, a painting, anything at all. And it strikes at the heart of, you know, whether you believe it is possible to really use language of any kind. Leave digital out of it for a second, because what we have in the Facebook avatar, which, by the way, and importantly, doesn't have legs, like doesn't have an existence below the belt, and so is sort of detached even from,
hopefully, like the, it doesn't have existence below the
yeah, for now,
because exactly. A lot of the internet does.
Well, that's the right. Well, but this, so okay, but this you're onto something, because this is so important. You know, so much of the internet, famously, right, is saturated with this kind of oversexed, like pornographic stuff. Even if it's not porn, it sometimes feels like porn, you know, on Instagram or whatever. And yet, that whole phenomenon has taken on this really weird desexed, denatured quality. That it's now got this dialectic between like an imaginary sex fantasy that no human body can actually fulfill in a real intimate relationship. And you see this all the time with, you know, young men, especially, that then get into relationships and expect things out of their girlfriends that they're totally either unable to provide or totally disgusted at having to provide. So there's obviously some kind of fissure there, or disjuncture going on between real life and fantasy kind of replacing real life. And then, like, at the opposite end of this, you have, if everything is sex, then nothing is sex, right? And that if everything is kind of this erotic panoply, this extreme, then really you stop being able to be aroused or in your body at all. And so this kind of, again, just really aggravates a long-standing philosophical problem, which is, okay, that we know there is the sign, we know there is the symbol, but does the symbol refer to anything? Is there anything behind the screen, behind the word, behind the gesture, behind the glance? And one reason why the real is so hard and kind of ineffable, I think, is that it does rest on a leap of faith that behind any of these material gestures, these outward signs, inadequate or incomplete as they may be, the thing communicated actually exists. When AI became a big deal, I went back and read Turing's 1950 paper on the Turing test, on how you can tell whether something is sentient or not. And it was incredibly striking to me that the whole project of that paper is to wave away the question whether communication actually originates in any sentient experience. Turing's whole point is, if a machine can do the things that people do when they think, then it is thinking. And his central argument for this is that when people do the things that make us think they think, we don't actually have any proof other than the outward show that they are having the experience we have when we think. And so if we can't prove that here in this relationship, across Zoom, across a room, in an art gallery, why should we expect machines to prove that? And it seems like, to me, this is a perfect articulation of exactly the wrong way to approach the question, which is helpful in some sense. And you see this now all the time, with people have no way of saying, of distinguishing between a machine that can pretend to think and another person that can actually think, because we've basically lost our faith that anyone is doing anything other than pretending, than putting up a kind of screen or artifice. I guess I feel a sense of urgency about this, precisely because if there is a leap of faith that people are having trouble taking, it's that there's something on the other end of the line, something behind the symbol and the signified. One reason why the pastor who says, no, this is the real world, or the Jonathan Peugeot who says, no, the symbol actually gets at something realer than the physical, the material of the symbol, which is basically Freud in inverse. Like it's, it, again, flipping Freud and Turing on their heads and saying actually underneath the symbol is something that the only the symbol can get you into, which is reality full stop. And you have to kind of assert that in order to stay human at all, I guess.
And, you know, one thing in my training, doing psychotherapy was just how, like, you know, my mentor over and over again say, you have to sit in the silence. You have to sit in the silence. So like when I have someone across from me, number one, so like when you close the door and Michael, you were alluding to this, and Spencer, you said the same. I think you were also touching on this. So yeah, like, you know, online therapy is huge today, but when you actually invite someone in and you have the client and you have me in the same room and you shut that door, well, two things usually occur, okay, from my experience thus far, is that number one is that when you both sit down and you make eye contact, there's a silence that occurs. Whether it's like, and that ranges from honestly like 1 second to 15 seconds, right? Before before you have that Mexican standoff, right? And then someone talks. That's number one. But number two, it derives from the first thing, right? And even if it's just a second, this is really hard because I never actually verbalized this before to anyone, but you both have this acknowledgement that the silence actually just created something. And again, it doesn't matter how long the silence was. Hang on 1 second as an airplane flies over my house.
We can't hear it.
I can't hear it.
Oh, so even that, like, you know, oh, that's good. Even that, like, you know, the silence, right? It's, I guess that right there was just a great example, right? So like you're preparing for something. So when the psychotherapist and the client have that silence, you acknowledge that, again, this spirit just came into the room, that you just created something very real. And if you don't have that silence, right, if you go up into the room and you close the door and you just automatically start talking, it's interesting that the counseling relationship automatically will look different than an individual that you worked with where the silence was actually acknowledged, right? Because you, in some way, that silence, right, what you're actually acknowledging is that, for me, you know, is that, okay, well, you know, God, the spirit has just literally entered this, or we've both realized that there is something real that we cannot necessarily verbalize, right? And then it frees you and it makes you more open to having a more honest conversation. My wife and I always joke around about this. It might either be a testament to, I guess, how our marriage, and maybe that, you know, we need to talk more, but my wife and I, because we're all married here, and so I'm actually just curious what your experience is with this. When we go out to a restaurant by ourselves, which is now far and few between, but when we used to go to a restaurant by ourselves, and when we have the date night, you can almost always tell how long someone's been married or that they're dating with how much talking they're doing while eating. So, you know, my wife and I have not been married for long. We've been married for 5 years, which is by no means long, but we've also been together since we were 18 years old. We know each other very well, and we are very comfortable with silence. And when we're out to eat, maybe it's because we have, you know, a crazy two-year-old at home, but I actually think it's because we sit in the silence with each other, and we almost are communicating. There's an energy that we both acknowledge, and we're almost communicating through the silence rather than through any verbalization. And again, Spencer, to what you were saying, it's just like that's the acknowledgement of that we're acknowledging that something actually very real is taking place. Someone might look at us and say, "Oh my gosh, look at that married couple; they're not talking," but they must have a horrible relationship. But no, actually, quite on the actual opposite side of that, right? The other side of the coin is that no, we're comfortable in the silence, and we acknowledge that silence is actually good because we were acknowledging that, right? There's something very real taking place during the situation, during the phenomena that we're both in.
Thanks, Joe. So actually, I'm going to take it in a slightly different direction. Just what you were speaking about, and a few things have made me think about it. If you want to explore this, we can. If not, that's okay. So like you said there, I was listening to Stephen Meyer on Joe Rogan's podcast too, and he was critiquing figures like Hume and this notion that we're just the sense perception. There is no integral self. I think that's part of the problem with the transhumanist fiction, so to speak, that there's no coherent self, which makes sense. If there's no God, I think the Buddha is right, that there is no self either. And I don't know why one would bind themselves to an idea that there is a unified self or a soul or whatever. But obviously the biblical perspective is that we are this nephesh. And I'm curious about that contrast between our Christian understanding and some of those other worldviews as it pertains to these very real things that we're speaking about. It's not just abstract philosophy with no practical significance. It's ultimately significant. And so in Spencer's book, he talks about this, the crisis of the body, for example. And I'm curious, how do we live convivially, as Ivan Illich talks about? So he uses this example, I think, of being convivial within limits. So the car came along and life became better in some ways, but so you could move more quickly, but then eventually you had so much traffic that it slowed down. So that you want to get this balance of kind of conviviality and so on. And I'm curious what a convivial Christian life lived through the body. So we are those personas that Paul was talking about, and Roger Scruton is really good in this, that I can't remember the German word he uses, but that part of ourselves can be real. But if we make it kind of like an idol of it, then it becomes hyper-real. So I'm curious if any of you guys have any, obviously from a Christian perspective, I trust what God has revealed to us, that we are this unified person, this nephesh, embodied soul and so on. But I'm curious about how we might understand that, why it's important. Does that make sense the way I phrased it? Or does anyone want to speak to that?
Yes. You know, last time I went out to visit my parents, my dad and I went on this walk together, and we were talking about artificial enhancements to the human person. So if you can put a microchip in your brain and get smarter, or if you can be faster. And you know, we're both relatively comfortable with the distinction between restoring a healthy function and maximizing or enhancing an otherwise perfectly functional organ. So if you're blind and then you have a machine that can make you see, that's fine. Or at least that's one kind of thing. And if you, however, are basically a average baseline human being with sight, and then suddenly you have a machine that shows you other wavelengths of light and therefore different colors, there's sort of a difference there. But then we got to talking about IQ, and I was toying with this problem that, you know, if you made me or somebody else, you know, 200 IQ points smarter, somehow I feel that my personhood would have been irrevocably compromised, that there would be you would have blown the boundaries off of me so that there was no longer an outline of Spencer. On the other hand, if you made me one or two IQ points smarter, my intuition is not really that I would be a totally different person. And this got me thinking about Thomas Aquinas has this concept of the inseparable accident, which is something that's not essential to you as a quality, that you can define or talk about a person without reference to that thing, and yet you can't actually extract that away. And I was wondering if Aquinas says that sex is this, that male and female are inseparable accidents. So it's not essential to your humanity to be either male or female. You can be either one and still be defined as a human, but you can't remove or flip one of them and retain the self. And I'm starting to wonder or worry over whether almost all of our accidents might be somehow inseparable, that it's our incarnate humanity, our embodied humanity that sets the limits and the boundaries of us. And at least if those things are going to change, they have to change in a gradual and continuous way that has a certain logic, the way that a tree growing out of an acorn has a logic. And the only other thing that I have to say about this, which is not, I'm afraid I'm not going to land this plane. This is not, I'm not going to, you know, resolve this into some neat package, but Joe and I have been reading this book, Meditations on the Tarot, together. And it's been incredibly challenging and rich and interesting. And one of the things that we last night when we were talking about it started to realize or arrive at is that this book has a whole kind of attitude about prayer that amounts essentially to stilling the monkey mind. It has a real resemblance to Buddhist or Zen meditation. And it often will freely make reference to yogic practices and all of these things that Christians are typically somewhat allergic to or suspicious of. And one thing I was saying is, you know, the fundamental difference here between this and anything I've ever done as a mode of, you know, yoga meditation or Zen practice is that the point of emptying yourself out in this kind of Christian prayer is for somebody else to come in, that your personhood is not designed to be dissolved around the edges, but is designed to be filled up, fleshed out, and made complete in relationship with other minds. Mm-hmm. And so maybe I am circling around to something like a point here, which is that it's actually in relationship with one another, which is mediated through the body, which can't happen except by, so if you have limits and I have limits and there's a space therefore between us, it's in that interchange that we become most fully ourselves. We don't even, you know, have a fully formed personality, I don't think, until we form these relationships where we're able to manifest the kind of ineffable, inchoate selfhood that is so famously within us. And perhaps it's this that makes me so worried or concerned over the question of sort of customizable human beings, because it's the fact of us, the givenness of us, and that is embodiment. There's no, you know, distinction really for me between that and embodiment, that makes it possible for us to face one another and communicate between one another, and in doing so to be the kind of thing that we are.
Well, you know, yesterday, one of my students at the college where I teach contacted me because he wanted to get my thought. He's the editor of the college newspaper, and he wanted to get my thoughts about AI and ChatGPT and what that means for teaching and scholarship and students writing papers. Because I already know the students have been using ChatGPT to write papers. If they were using, you know, those, you can get those, you know, I called it crappypapers.com. Why write your own C paper when you can buy one for $5, right? But he actually, the reason he wanted to talk to me, you know, he's a pretty perceptive student, but he read the article I wrote for Spencer.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Okay. The Droid Stares Back, which actually, the joke about my Substack, the Druid Stares Back, because I was looking up the Droid Stares Back and I misspelled it and it came out Druid. Like, that's kind of that's catchy. I might use it. But anyway, the thing I talked about when he called me was that, you know, we're at this weird moment where AI and ChatGPT, as Spencer was mentioning earlier, is starting to imitate, you know, like with the Turing test, human intelligence, And it could trick you, certainly. Where on the other hand, some people, not everybody, but the danger for humans is there's this kind of reciprocal relationship where humans become more machine-like. And as Spencer was just saying, with this idea of, you know, you can retrofit your body to fit how you think you are, right? Or your feelings about what you are, is extraordinarily dangerous, because this is what transhumanism is, right? It's the other side of transhumanism, you know, the one side is making the human more machine-like or more technology-like, but the flip side is making technology more human-like, which is dangerous, right? And it's an escape from the real. And what is the antidote to that, right? What is the antidote to that? And it's almost like a sickness that's running through our society right now. So if we think, when Spencer was talking, and a big influence on Valentin Tonberg, who wrote Meditations of the Tarot, was Rudolf Steiner, and who has a really, I think, sound anthropology. And one thing he talks about is the personality, right? And if you think about yourself, right, my personality now is certainly different than it was, though some things are certainly common, than when I was 18 or 19, right? But some things are very different from my personality now from it was 10 years ago, 5 years ago. But the other part of that is what Steiner calls the individuality, right? So, which, you know, is closer to what we would call the spirit of the soul, right? The individuality, who you are, right? Mm-hmm. And personality is more chameleon-like and adapting to the environment sometimes, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, that personality is formed by your environment. I've noticed since I kind of got out of the throes of academia, when I hear people talk like academics, I'm like, oh, just stop. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just, can you use real world words, please? But that's personality, right? That's personality. And what is it, this kernel, this individuality, and which, you know, that's, you know, the image likeness of God, in a way you could say. But it's also the uniqueness of the individual at the same time. So it's kind of a curious thing, right? So that part of our being in which we participate in God. And Spencer was mentioning some of the prayer practices that Tonberg talks about in that book. But what was interesting for me, now my doctorate is in early modern English literature, in particular with religious literature. And when I was getting ready to do that and getting geared up for writing the dissertation, I decided I really need to do a deep dive in medieval English mysticism. Because I had to understand the English religious tradition, because it's different. And when I was working on, in particular, the metaphysical poets like John Donne and Thomas Traherne and George Herbert, Henry Vaughan. But going into medieval English mysticism was really important. And in particular, the importance of the cloud of unknowing, which is very Buddhist-like in its way, in the way the prayer recommended there is not like we would think of prayer. It's a kind of deactivation of the intellect, right? So, and it's a prayer method that is almost like what do they call it, practicing the presence of God, right? It's that kind of being present, which is, for me, that has been probably the richest prayer experience of my life, is entering into that. And it's very simple, and because it's very simple, it's very difficult. But it also disables the intellect, right? Just like in phenomenology, the idea is to disable or to bracket our assumptions about whatever the thing is we're presented with, and to learn how to be present to the phenomena itself.
We were talking last night.
Oh, yep, exactly. Yeah, no, go on. I think. Yeah, go ahead.
Just that we both found very striking in the first chapter of Meditations on the Tarot, the passage in which St. Dionysius is beheaded and walks with his head in his hands to his burial place of choice. And this is kind of an image of the sort of prayer, but also just engagement with the world that the author is advocating. And yeah, that, like, not that you're headless altogether, but that your head's not the one doing the leading. It's very interesting.
So what I'm hearing is that we're going to be at our event. We'll come in and we're just going to be silent the whole time.
Yeah, in this group, that's a fat chance.
I'm not going to say a damn thing.
Right, right.
It's just absolute no. I mean, we'll get in.
No talking.
That's what it will be.
Everyone's going to demand their money back. Not enough words. There aren't enough words.
Oh my goodness. And do you have any key thoughts on that, Paul, that you'd like to share?
Yeah, I just found what everybody said very interesting. It made me think of the part of what's been rolling around in theology has been, I mean, process theology, where, you know, sort of following Whitehead, where we're going to, one way to think about it, perhaps to sort of simplify it, is a skepticism of nouns and a prioritization of verbs, let's say. But the truth is, the sentence is fairly meaningless without both nouns and verbs. And John Vervaeke has this term he calls the transjective, which I think in many ways is sort of the space between nouns and verbs. And in some ways, what I hear us sort of pinging at is the space between talking and listening. Listening is in many ways presence. It is not obliteration. It is not annihilation, because there is face there. There is presence there. So every week at the end of the service, because I haven't decided to memorize a bunch of other common doxology or blessings from the New Testament, I just usually use the Mosaic blessings. And, you know, the Lord turn his face towards you. The Lord bless you and keep you and turn his face toward you. And so on one hand, we started this conversation talking about the proliferation of our own faces. There's Pastor Paul, there's YouTuber Paul, there's Paul, who's the husband and the father and the neighbor. So we have this proliferation of faces. We have this cultivation of profilicity, cultivation of profile, in order to use our faces to affect the world in a certain way. But we've been talking now about faces that listen. You know, one of the big pastorally, the silence of God and the problematic presence of God is something that comes up again and again for people. Now, what I mean by the problematic presence of God, Nathan Jacobs got his PhD at Calvin Seminary. Good for him. And to the dismay of those professors at Calvin Seminary, he went to Orthodoxy after that. And, you know, it was kind of like Peter Kreeft getting his Calvin college education and becoming Roman Catholic. These things aren't supposed to happen in the Christian Reformed Church. We educated you, stay with us. But so Nathan Jacob made a film, which was mostly conversations with people who had walked away from church, the nuns and the duns. And surprising no one, the problem of evil comes up for many people. And I don't think the problem of evil is as abstract as we like to imagine it is. That sort of sounds disembodied, the problem of evil. What I think in a lot of ways it is the problem of presence, that, well, God is God, one woman tells a moving story of her uncle, a beloved uncle, who died in a house fire because he fell asleep with a cigarette in his mouth. And this was kind of this was a big deal back in the 70s. People would talk about it. You don't hear about it much anymore, but you know, you're smoking and you're laying in bed and you fall asleep with a cigarette and the cigarette falls out and lights the sheet and starts a conflagration and you die. And the woman's narrative about the problematic presence of God was, would it have been so hard for an omnipotent God to just pick up the cigarette and put it in the ashtray? And so in many ways, what has happened with nuns and duns is that it's easier to remove God's presence from the world. It's easier to have a God, either a impersonal God who cannot act, or an absent God who at least won't be to blame when the cigarette tumbles from the mouth and consumes a beloved uncle. And so it strikes me pastorally, these are many of the issues that we deal with. Okay, yes, I want God's presence, but what if, and this is always the problem in a relationship, when in a middle-class church, in a poor church, people come to the pastor hoping for help with a lot of practical things that can be helped without too much money or too much difficulty. In a middle class or upper class church, people come to the pastor wanting help with all of the people's relationships. Yeah, because I can't get my spouse to do this. I can't get my kids or my parents to do this. And again, that's more problematic presence. And so it's this in-between space between faces that in many ways, this is where we're sort of looking for agency. Where we're hoping deliverance can come.
Boy, you're reminding me. I met these Catholic educators at this bar after work kind of thing. They invited me. I said, I don't know what you want to talk to me about. But one guy's telling this story about this church festival where there's a contest where you fill like a tankard with ale and you see who can hold it out the longest, right? Mm. It's like an Ironman contest. And they're big tankards, right? And apparently there were these big muscular dudes, right? And they're holding it out and they're like, they get in 10 minutes and they start shaking. And there's this little skinny guy who pulls he's got his tankard out and he's shaking a little bit too, but he's in his other hand, he has his rosary, right? Mm. And so the guy's getting into this story and telling me all about this and saying, and so the skinny guy wins the contest. And I remember he was kind of mad at me. I said, well, too bad God couldn't do that about the Holocaust.
Yeah.
You know, God cares more about a beer contest than the Holocaust. Uh-huh. I'm in the wrong place. Yeah.
Oh, man. Huh. Yeah, I'm shocked. I'm shocked that didn't go over well, Michael.
Clearly, there weren't enough rosaries in Germany.
That was the real problem. Yeah, if they had rosaries. No.
Of course.
Coffee. It's coffee.
Right. I think I almost went to one of those competitions once. In Texas, they have a beer festival every year. And we went, and there was one, but we kind of missed it because we were busy doing other things, probably drinking beer.
Don't bet against the mystic.
That's right. That's right. We should have brought our rosaries. I'm thinking this stuff about the transjective, Paul, maybe this is already a feature of the discourse, so I forgive me, but it does occur to me that, you know, Hebrew words have precisely that character, that they are nouns and verbs sort of interchangeably. I mean, it's not that they can serve any purpose at any time, but that the same root will transform easily from word to from thing to action, and that in general one of the reasons why Hebrew kind of blew my mind in grad school is that it's such a good language for talking about God for precisely this reason, that on the one hand God's actions are very much in time, on the other they're always sort of complete at every moment and stand outside of time. And that, yeah, like easy answers to these questions of pain and presence and suffering are in some ways a kind of insult to the sufferer and to God. I mean, that it always feels that way to me, at least, you know, that when people come with this stuff, the immediate impulse is to make it okay. And that's the first thing you probably shouldn't do, or try to say it's okay. And for me, one of the biggest arguments for Christianity coming to it from the outside was that actually nothing makes it okay this side of paradise, that in fact the only conceivable answer is the inconceivable one that has to take place in infinity. I mean, this is sort of what happens in the Brothers Karamazov, that Ivan can't accept the only form of consolation that could possibly be accepted for the suffering, for instance, of children, which is that parallel lines meet at infinity, that you're really dealing with something that requires you to accept like the existence of something completely outside of all space and time. I don't know if anybody can hear. If you can't hear the airplane, you probably can't hear the big old thunderstorm, the thunderclap we just got in here, but we're apparently in for a big one. The only other thing to dwell on Hebrew for a second is that it occurs to me that the great command, I mean, I love this idea of may the Lord turn his face to you. And then, of course, the other great command is the Shema, hear, listen, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. And right, listening is in fact like a maybe the highest form of presence for humans, right? Is that the only answer to suffering that has ever done anything like satisfying for me is the suffering God, that God's presence in suffering is the answer, and not his sort of like making up for it. Anyway, you know, that's
no, Spencer, that makes total sense. You know, and Spencer and I were having a private conversation probably what last week. And I was actually almost venting to him, and I was talking about, well, I guess the part this particular conversation within the larger conversation was about evangelization and how I personally struggle with, you know, I feel like my spiritual life is beefing up, right? And I feel closer to God than any other point in my life right now, but I feel guilty. I was telling Spencer, I feel horribly guilty because I don't know. And Spencer and I, like, and part of it is actually because of our reading on meditations on the tarot. And I don't know, how do I properly evangelize these things to individuals? And I mean, you kind of actually told me what you were just stating now. You said something, I don't know if you remember this, but you said you just have to listen to them, right? That's the first step, is listening. And that really stuck with me, because what I've noticed, and I apologize that I keep on alluding to my career, but it's so important. I Spencer, I've told you this before, I've told my wife before, how I don't feel more human. Right, I feel like I am literally living the most that I can. I am like living at the highest capacity that I could live almost when I am counseling someone, and it's because what I'm doing is I'm just listening to them. Mm-hmm. Paul, you have to know exactly what I mean, being a pastor, because the commonplace between the pastor and there's a serious overlap between the pastor and the therapist, right? It's just like when you just are truly listening to someone. I think of for some faults that he has. I mean, I think that's the greatest insight that Carl Rogers had, right? With an unconditional positive regard, is just sitting with someone and listening to them. And you don't actually have to. It's funny, like in like the psychological world, we call them micro skills, right? And it can be anywhere from making a meaning reflection to making a repetitive word reflection. But what Carl Rogers did, and truly what he still continues to do, is just sit there, right? Let the silence happen and just sit there and just listen. And I've never felt, I feel so strong and so alive. And I feel like the best version of Joe during that counseling session, right? Because my phone's in my office. I don't have a worry in the world. And I say a prayer before I start all my counseling sessions, right? For myself and for the client. And I just listen, right? I tell God to give me, you know, give me his ear almost. And it's, and this is exactly what you are all describing in some way. And like I said, Paul, you have to know exactly what I'm talking about being a pastor.
Yeah, well, that's a dirty little secret of pastoring, which is in most cases, you don't have anything, any advice that you can give to people to fix what it is right. That they desperately want fixing. Most of the time, the best you can do is listen well and be with them in their suffering. Pain shared is pain divided. Joy shared is joy multiplied.
Thank you very much for your time today, gents. And I've most enjoyed listening to you guys. Pardon me, terrible, almost a pun there. And yes, I suppose just, I know you have to go in a few moments, so I wanted to just say, we've got a good flavor of what to expect in DC. What you'd like to say to those who maybe are thinking about coming, that haven't went over the edge yet, or any closing thoughts? I'll start with yourself, Michael.
Well, I just hope to see people there, and because, you know, I think it's a great opportunity to be in the real world and we're looking to the future in a way in the theme of this conference, but there is no future without a present and without presence, right? So I think that's an important thing.
Thanks, Michael. Paul?
Well, I start out saying I say yes to things. Well, it's not true that I say yes to everything, but I do say yes to things like this, which are about presence. And none of you were at the Chino event that we just did in Southern California. But what was so remarkable about that event, what people told me, because I asked quite a few people, okay, why did you come? Why are you here? What did you get out of it? And for almost all of them, it was exactly what Michael described, that these are people who had, you know, been listening to myself or Vicky Peugeot online. And what was big about the conference was not so much what we said on stage. That was recorded and you can find it on my channel. And that was good. That was fine. What was big in the event was the conversations that people were able to have with each other right away. And I just did an estuary. I just did my local estuary Thursday night. And again, same thing. And one of the women said, she said, you know, I'm an introvert. And so I hate like all of the, I feel very insecure about the small talk and all of this. And so often you have to get through all of these levels to get where I want to go in the relationship or in the conversation, which is, and again, it's about presence and it's about face and it's about listening and caring. It's all of those things. And I can't promise, you can talk to Joe if get your money back if you're dissatisfied, I suppose. But but what these events have done is given people a chance to get into a space where they could very quickly be present and meet others and have that kind of community. And I'm hoping that happens here. I can't guarantee it, obviously, but that is what I go for.
Lovely. Thanks, Paul. And yourself, Spencer?
Well, I certainly want to co-sign everything that's just been said. When I started my podcast, I found it very jarring to speak into a camera or into an iPhone or whatever, because, you know, if you listen to podcasts, you may not kind of realize that on the other end, there's somebody with this kind of big gaping black eye staring at him, and or this metal, you know, apparatus, this weird machine called the microphone. And it's at first extremely difficult to, or I found it very difficult to get natural, to be present in that mode until I realized that the secret is the eye, the camera, the machine, whatever. It's not actually the camera. It's not this black hole. It's somebody else making breakfast, wondering about their kids, thinking about what to do at school, up against some problem. And from then on, truly the best thing for me about making content, quote unquote, of any kind, is just imagining myself in relationship with all these other people on the other end of that line. And so if you're, you know, a listener to this stuff, or you've encountered any of our work and you're listening to us here now, I guess I'd just say, like, come to the table. Like, we want to meet you. You know, we're in your ear a lot. And so you've invited us into your lives, and that makes us feel really grateful, but it would be amazing, you know, to just see your face. And that's mm-hmm. the value add here. That's kind of what I think we're offering is, you know, come to the table and like, let's make this a two-way street.
Beautiful. Thanks, Spencer. And your chef, Joe, the maestro.
I don't have anything to say. I guess, you know, I think everyone else said it perfectly. You know, I hope to see, I guess, you know, it's interesting because I do hope to see more people come. But for those of you who've been on the Eventbrite page, you would know that even if we reached max capacity, it's still going to be a small event, right? 80 people max. That's very small. Paul, how much, really quick, what was Chino?
Chino was 200 people.
So, right, exactly. And I will say this much, we are not at max capacity. So we do not have 80 people coming. That's a blessing in some way, right? Because, with so many people who want to be part of the conversation, who have really profound, beautiful, good things to say, as Spencer put it, right? Come make this a two-way street. And as it thunderstorms now in Cleveland, Ohio, I don't know if you can hear the rain, but I guess I'll just echo what he said and make this a two-way street. Really excited to meet everyone, and just truly excited to see what is created out of this event.
Thanks, Joe. Thank you very much, gents. It's been a pleasure to listen
to you
all today. Thank you. Looking forward.
Looking forward to seeing y'all.
Yep, me too. 2 weeks.
At least if you're watching this on my channel, the link is below in the description, so you can find it there.
Mine too.
And you can click on it there. So.
Thanks, guys.
Take care.